Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to The Game Changers, the podcast that celebrates trailblazing women in sport. I'm Sue Anstis, and I'd like to start with a big thank you to our partners Sport England, who support The Game Changers through a National Lottery Award. I'm delighted to say that this, the 13th season of the podcast, is a serialisation of my book, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport. Chapter 2, 12 Game-Changing Moments. It's not women's bodies that are the problem, it's their minds. They just don't seem to be able to concentrate as well as men, which is why they'll never break into the male preserve of championship snooker. Admittedly, their shape doesn't help. Big breasts can make the game very awkward. But it's that lack of mental control which finally prevents them becoming top class. Steve Davis, Sunday Standard, 1981. We've seen a significant positive shift for women's sport in the past decade. But this unstoppable rise, with increases in funding, profile and respect for women's sport, hasn't happened in a smooth, linear fashion. Like all social change, it's been punctuated with specific events and individual actions that have each shifted the narrative to drive this movement forward to where we sit today. I'm often asked when I first decided to focus my energy on increasing the impact of women's sport. Had I always been frustrated about the inequalities faced by female athletes, the smaller sponsorship budgets, unequal media coverage, fewer opportunities for girls in sport? For me, it's been a gradual realisation. I'm embarrassed to admit that for most of my life, it was just something that I accepted. I didn't really question the status quo or feel I had the right to call it out. It was just what had always been for as long as I could remember competing and working in sport. Women's sport became a real priority and focus for me in 2012, with the London Olympics and the formation of the Women's Sport Trust charity. Looking back over the years since then, there are a number of key moments which have had a significant impact on women's sport in the UK. Here are 12 of those moments which resonate most with me personally in terms of creating the positive change we see in women's sport today. You may have your own memories of the most important moments. I'd love to hear about them. Number 1. The London Olympics 2012. I'm clearly not alone in citing the 2012 London Olympics as a tipping point for women's sport. It was, after all, the first Olympics where women competed in all events. There were more women than men in the US team for the first time, with female athletes making up almost half of Team GB. Things have certainly moved on from the first modern Olympics in 1896, when all the competitors were men. Jacques Rogge, president of the International Olympic Committee, reflected that the London Games could undoubtedly trigger increased equality for women. Opening the Olympic Games to more women is not just a matter of basic fairness. The Games provide a global platform for female Olympians that inspires others to follow their example. More than 4 billion people, well over half the world's population, will have access to watch the London Games. About half of that audience will be women and girls, a gender balance few other major sporting events can hope to match. That global reach makes the Games a powerful force for gender equality. The fight for equality was on display from the very first night when suffragettes, singing their anthem, March of the Women, entered the stadium as part of Danny Boyle's magnificent opening ceremony. It was also the first time countries such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Brunei sent female athletes to any Olympic Games. Some claim the small numbers of women from these countries, just 2 from Saudi, 4 from Qatar, and 1 from Brunei, was tokenistic. But for me, their appearance sent a significant message that left women hopeful of improvements in the future. Other female firsts from London 2012 saw Nicola Adams become the first female Olympic boxing champion, the final sport to achieve gender equality, and that extraordinary night for women's football when Team GB beat Brazil at Wembley in front of a crowd of 70,584. The poster girl for London 2012, Jessica Ennis-Hill, won an extraordinary gold in the heptathlon on Super Saturday, with women changing perceptions in other sports too. How could you not get emotional watching Jade Jones' enormous passion as she celebrated her taekwondo gold? Or feel the heartbreak of Sinead Reed finishing 6th in an action-packed BMX final? Across the Olympics and Paralympics, British female athletes had incredible success, winning golds in everything from cycling, equestrian, athletics and swimming, through to shooting, sailing and archery. A memorable highlight for me, and I know I wasn't the only person in tears, was watching Catherine Granger finally win a rowing gold with Anna Watkins at Dorney Lake. The London 2012 Games put our extraordinary female athletes front and centre, and the entire nation loved it. Number 2, Women's Sport Trust, 2013. For Tammy Parler and Joe Bostock, the co-founders of the Women's Sport Trust, it was the profile of women athletes during London 2012 that drove them to create their hugely influential charity. Tammy recalls her frustration when all the wonderful media coverage of female athletes we'd enjoyed that summer just dwindled away as the Olympics ended. It was a wake-up call for Tammy, a Hapkido master, and she persuaded her wife Jo, whose day job was helping companies be inclusive and diverse, to join her in setting up the Women's Sport Trust. I was lucky enough to get involved as one of the founding trustees when board meetings took place around the kitchen table in Jo and Tammy's home. What has followed in the past 9 years has been quite extraordinary. The impact of this small charity has been transformative for women's sport in the UK, and it's little wonder that both Jo and Tammy were awarded MBEs in the Queen's New Year's Honours List in 2019 for their services to gender equality in sport. I asked Jo to tell me more about how it all started. Tammy was a trigger. She was a catalyst, and she is the pure athlete and the one who really, from a sporting standpoint, wanted female athletes and sport to get the profile, coverage and investment it deserved. Jo told me the bit that she brought into the mix was around inclusion, systemic change, influencing. I think you get a lot of change done by connecting brilliant people to a brilliant idea and then just stirring. So much of WST's success has been relational. If you notice the system's a wee bit broken, so sport wasn't talking to media and business to business, they weren't tending to mix much. We stirred them together and made it fun rather than boring. One of the most powerful phrases Jo uses, and she really is the queen of the superb soundbite, was that the Women's Sport Trust was the provocative glue. We bring people together as a catalyst for conversations behind the scenes. And moving women's sport from worthy to irresistible is a central goal of the WST, whether talking to sponsors, broadcasters, rights holders, or sports governing bodies. The WST's work has included major events such as the powerful Be a Game Changer Awards, which celebrated the visionaries and game changers driving the future of women's sport at all levels and used their example to inspire action from others. Partnerships have also played an important role. In 2017, the charity partnered with Getty Images to increase the visibility of female athletes and women's sports, while also challenging the way in which they are portrayed in imagery. Activities included new creative and editorial collections focusing on women's sport, two paid internships, and the establishment of new visual guidelines for the industry. In 2018, WST launched the Show Up campaign with Sky Sports to encourage everyone to show up and support women's sport by watching, attending, or playing. The hashtag Onside campaign also launched that year in partnership with the Rugby Football Union, with an ambition to engage men and boys as role models to speak up and take action to support women and girls in sport. The summer of 2020 saw the launch of the charity's potentially most powerful campaign to date, Unlocked. It paired 41 elite female athletes who all wanted to be changemakers within and beyond their sports with 41 leading figures from business, sport and media. The impact it had on the lives and reach of these athletes exceeded even our most ambitious expectations. I'm delighted that Unlock 2 is now underway. Finally, during COVID-19, the WST's Ambition Project brought together 54 leaders from across sport, including media, brands, agencies, sports rights holders, national governing bodies, and athletes to consider what needs to change in order to achieve our ambition for women's sport. The resulting report and recommendations were shared across sport in 2021. I'm incredibly proud to be a trustee of the Women's Sport Trust. Number 3, the Women's Boat Race, 2015. The women's boat race was traditionally held at Henley the week before the men's boat race, which takes place on the Thames in London. This annual rowing race between Oxford and Cambridge University's women's boat clubs had first taken place in 1927, when the Times reported that large and hostile crowds gathered on the towpath, objecting to the women rowing. As it happens, the women weren't actually allowed to race against each other. This was considered unladylike, and some of the male organisers were worried that the intense rowing might damage women's insides. The teams therefore rowed one after the other. The early races were not even about the fastest boat. The style of the rowers was judged downstream and the speed on the way back upstream. The race became an annual competition in 1964, and by 1977, with the boats now racing against each other in a traditional format, the women's boat race was given an annual slot at the Henley Royal Regatta. It might have stayed there forever, but for a woman with a passion to bring some equality to the boat race. Helena Morrissey was the CEO of Newton Asset Management when her investment firm decided to sponsor the women's race in 2011. Until that time, the women's event had had no funding at all. The female rowers had to buy their own kit and pay for transport, as elite sportswomen have had to do in the past, and many continue to do today. When Newton's parent company, BNY Mellon, later took on the entire sponsorship of the boat race, Helena Morrissey insisted on a few conditions. The funding must be split equally between the men and the women must also receive equal billing to the men. While this clearly upset many traditionalists, it made sense that an event with a massive global profile of the boat race should have gender parity. Fortunately, the BBC also supported the new move to enhance what was already one of its highest viewed sporting events. So, on Saturday, the 11th of April, 2015, history was made on the Thames in London when the women's boat race took place on the same stretch of the river as the men's for the very first time. The women's event was watched by 4.8 million viewers, and I must confess to an emotional tear as I watched the BBC preview compilation video that showed the women in the build-up to the big day, with some fantastic editing and a powerful soundtrack. I'd watched the boat race as a child with my parents and never once questioned why women weren't rowing too. It now seems so significant to witness them finally receiving equal billing alongside the men. Claire Balding, who should have been fronting TV coverage of the Grand National that day, made a very public decision to host the BBC's coverage of the women's boat race instead. I asked her why. My feeling was with the women's boat race, I really wanted to support it. Believe me, it was not a financial decision that was sensible, but I felt very strongly that sometimes you've got to put your money where your mouth is and do it. I don't regret that for a second. My parents didn't understand it. A lot of people in racing didn't understand it, but that's what I wanted to do. I appreciate that for many people, the perception of the boat race is that it's just a bunch of privileged Oxbridge toffs racing on the water. On some levels, it's hard to disagree with this analysis. That said, the women's boat race in 2015 makes my top 12 because it demonstrated the power of corporate sponsorship to drive gender equality in sport on an enormous global stage. Number 4, GB Hockey Gold, Rio 2016. Hockey has been a part of my life for many years. Not as a player, I'd only played a little in school, but I was welcomed into the hockey family when the sports PR agency I ran began working for the national governing body in 2011. I had the privilege of working with England and GB Hockey in the build-up to 2012 and then in the years that followed, helping to raise a profile of campaigns including Back to Hockey, Hockey Fest, Rush Hockey and Team Up, all driving grassroots participation in the sport. At the London Olympics, the GB women had won an emotional medal. Their heroic captain, Kate Walsh, later Richardson Walsh, was hit in the face by a stick at the opening match against Japan, but returned after surgery to fix her broken jaw to lead the team to bronze. 4 years on, in 2016, and the team were ranked as one of the best in the world as they headed to compete in the Rio Olympics. The team progressed smoothly through the 2 weeks of competition to reach the finals without losing a single match, and support for them was building at home in Britain. For many viewers, the sight of these incredible, strong women sprinting and diving and powerfully striking balls was in stark contrast to the jolly hockey sticks image many had of the sport. The final, on Friday, the 19th of August, was against a formidable opposition, the Netherlands, who were hoping to win a third straight Olympic gold. The hugely competitive match finished 3-3 in normal time, with Maddie Hinch, our extraordinary goalkeeper, having made some remarkable saves. By the time it came to the penalty shootout, almost 10 million Britons were tuned in. The BBC's 10 o'clock news was delayed for the coverage as the nation held its breath and collectively realised that a penalty in hockey was not just a matter of stepping forward and striking the ball. After what felt like an eternity, with Maddie Hinch saving all the Dutch penalties and Helen Richardson-Walsh scoring a penalty strike, it was down to Holly Pern-Webb to step forward for the final decisive penalty. The moment at which she scored and GB women won their first ever Olympic gold will stay with me forever. In writing this, I thought it only right to watch that penalty shootout again. Even though I knew the outcome, it's still nail-biting to watch and so emotional to see the GB women and their support staff celebrating afterwards. Kate Richardson-Walsh, again the GB captain, gave an interesting response when I asked her how she felt as the team gathered for the penalty shootout. When the final whistle went, I celebrated, maybe a little too much, because I genuinely believed in that moment we had this. And I believe that because we'd beaten the Netherlands on penalties at the European Championships the year before. We'd also beaten them on penalties at the European Championships in 2013. So in the lead up to Rio, at all major tournaments, we had a really good set of results against the Dutch. Coupled with the fact that I know how much statistical analysis, video analysis, practice on the field, the goalkeepers and our penalty takers had all done. One of my abiding memories of the whole games is Kate, on the podium, lined up with the entire team, holding her gold medal in both hands and gazing at it emotionally. What was she feeling in that moment? Just so grateful and proud. It was almost a very quick flashback through everything I'd been through to get to that point, And then not just me, also reflecting on all the women around me, the women that weren't there, who hadn't been selected, the women who had gone before us. It was just that whole journey, I think, in that moment. The women's bronze in London and gold in Rio drove thousands of women and girls to start or restart playing hockey. I asked Sally Mundy what she was most proud of from her time as CEO at England and GB Hockey. It's not actually about the gold medal. It's about how our sport used that gold medal and used the bronze medal of 2012 to engage with our clubs and our hockey family to drive more participants. That's what I'm most proud about. Number 5, Muirfield, 2017. It was March 2017 when Muirfield, one of Scotland's last men-only golf clubs, finally allowed women to join for the first time. Sadly, the decision wasn't made because members recognised the misogyny of denying women access to their club, nor were they embarrassed following a worldwide condemnation of their refusal to allow women in 2016. According to a poll, almost 3/4 of Scots believe Muirfield Golf Club's ban on women members was damaging to Scotland's reputation. Yet despite groups and individuals campaigning for equal rights, lobbying members and signing petitions, and the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, saying the club's decision was indefensible and sent the wrong signal, the club wouldn't budge. No. The change of heart occurred only when the club was denied the right to host the prestigious Open Championships if it did not comply. The club had hosted the Open 16 times in the past, but golf's ruling body, the RNA, removed Muirfield as a potential host venue when it failed to allow women to join in 2016. Funnily enough, only weeks after the RNA announced its decision, Muirfield members voted to change the rules to allow women members. When it comes to gender equality, it seems that money talks. Following the club's change in policy, the RNA immediately announced that Muirfield was once again back in the rotation to stage the world's oldest major. Henry Fairweather, the club captain at the time, said it was a significant decision for the club, which retains many of the values and aspirations of its founding members. I'm not sure the values and aspirations of those founding members in 1744 included gender equality in any format. Recognising the significance of the vote, Nicola Sturgeon congratulated the club, tweeting, "Well done, Muirfield. Decision to admit women members, emphatic and the right one. Look forward to seeing you host the Open again in the future." Scotland is a modern country that wants to see gender equality become the norm across all parts of society, and today's decision is another step forward in that journey. Tracy Crouch, then UK Sports Minister, added, "This decision sends out an important message. It's vital that clubs and sports organisations play their part in promoting equality." For a sport that's desperate to modernise and bring more women on board, this was an important move in the right direction. Finally, in what could be viewed as a significant turnaround for the club, it has been announced that in 2022, Muirfield will host the Women's British Open for the first time. Number 6. The ban on walk-on girls, 2018. At the end of 2017, some momentous, and in my opinion, long overdue, decisions were made by first the Professional Darts Corporation, PDC, and then Formula One to stop the use of so-called walk-on girls and grid girls. The discussion around this had been prompted by a phone-in on BBC Radio 5 Live in December 2017, where presenter Jenny Gow had asked whether the use of grid girls was an outdated, sexist relic as the gender gap in sport narrows. The following year, on the back of the hashtag MeToo movement and the shock of the President's Club men-only dinner scandal, sports bodies and broadcasters took the decision that having scantily clad young women accompanying men to the hockey or strutting in front of them as they made their way to their cars wasn't quite the right image for sport. We were in the 21st century, after all. In response to these decisions, the Women's Sport Trust issued a statement to the media in which we clearly identified why we agreed it was time for sport to change its attitude to using women as accessories in this way. The Women's Sport Trust believes women in a sporting environment should be judged by their sports appeal and not sex appeal. We've been working with Getty to establish visual standards for the depiction of sportswomen, which focus less on what women look like and more on what they achieve. At a time when so much great work is being done to raise the visibility and increase the impact of women's sporting role models, it's disappointing to see that some of the highest profile international sporting events, such as motor racing, cycling, and boxing, still choose to use women to accessorize their events rather than be a central part of a sport. What sort of message are we sending women and girls about how they are valued? We're asking them to look at and admire the successful, talented, strong men taking part in the competition, whilst the role of women is purely based on their physical appearance. Whilst respecting a woman's right to choose what she does with her own body, we believe there is a clear role for every kind of woman and girl within sport, excelling, competing, and winning medals. We want sport to be a place where women of all shapes, sizes, and backgrounds feel welcome and able to actively participate. Sport mirrors and magnifies society. If we depict women in sport in a way that reinforces a narrow stereotype, we add to the pressure young girls in particular feel to look and act a certain way. If we depict women in a central, powerful, and sporting role, we create a positive, modern, and accurate image to inspire others. We are confident that the more savvy marketeers and sponsors will recognise that in the 21st century, the presence of grid girls is unacceptable and off-putting for many men and women. By continuing the outdated practice, the likes of boxing, cycling, and motor racing are potentially missing out on an opportunity to engage new audiences and excite new fans. The backlash to this statement was astonishing, as the tabloid media jumped on board and stoked a battle between the nasty feminists and the victimised glamour girls. Such was the vitriol for the Women's Sport Trust on Twitter that I joked about having a t-shirt printed with fat, hairy, vegan, lesbian feminazis to highlight some of the name-calling our trustees had received on social media in the weeks that followed. It was about this time that I first came across Stacey Copeland, a former England footballer who is now a professional boxer. I heard Stacey talking about the issue on a BBC Five Live interview call-in, and I was in awe. She was so calm and articulate about the whole subject, despite being faced with some very angry walk-on girls in the studio. Stacey explained to me why she felt the need to talk about the subject. I felt strongly about ringside girls from the very beginning. The only time I saw women in my sport was when they were dressed in very sexual outfits, walking around a ring with a piece of cardboard with a number on it. And that bothered me. It took so long for women to get the right to box. I know as a female boxer, I'm not as accepted as the males, despite doing all the same training as them and dedicating my life to it. Yet somebody who is there just for sexual appeal is? There's something wrong with that picture for me. Also, in an age where we're trying to teach boys about respect for women, consent, all of that, to take them to what is a sport event, not a lap dancing club, not a gentleman's club, but a sports event where people are shouting extremely sexualized, crude, and in my opinion, vile things, is totally socially unacceptable. Those boys are watching male role models act like that in a sports environment. To me, that's not what sport is about at all. How do female boxers feel about having ring girls at their events? I wasn't a fan of it, so I never had ring card girls from the start of my career. I had kids who were into boxing as my mascots, just like we have at Wimbledon or at football. Stacey raised an interesting point that I found myself making since. Imagine if at Wimbledon we suddenly changed and had court girls or net girls or whatever we'd call them. We would be saying, what's going on? We wouldn't have them at the Olympics or in football. Just because it has always been that way in my sport, it doesn't mean it is right. There was huge public backlash against Stacey for taking a stance and publicly speaking out against the use of ring girls. But she feels it was worth it because she's on the right side of history with this. Stacey wants things to be different for her young niece Ruby, for whom the only women she sees when she watches the Tour de France are the two women giving the winner a peck on the cheek as they pose beside him with a flirtatious leg lifted. I want her to grow up not seeing that. And I want her to look back on those things and say, Auntie Stacey, did there really used to be women who walked round a boxing ring in a bikini with a number on a piece of cardboard? And I'd say, yes, isn't that odd? Number 7, launch of Telegraph Women's Sport 2018. In 2018, the Telegraph made a big play for women's sport when it appointed Anna Kessel as women's sport editor. To support Anna and her newly appointed team, the paper committed substantial resources and investment to make a space for women's sport online and on its social channels, exploring video and Instagram posts, along with a dedicated monthly supplement and integration into the daily sports sections. What was particularly exciting about this was that rather than just appointing one woman to lead coverage of women's sport, Adam Sills, head of sport at the Telegraph, committed to an entire department. Anna was joined by Vicky Hodges as deputy editor, along with three full-time women's writers, Molly McElwee, Fiona Thomas and Katie Wyatt, and a dedicated social media editor, Fadumu Olo, added to the team in 2020. Elsewhere, across the paper in athletics, cycling, swimming, other journalists were covering both men's and women's sport. In describing the launch of Telegraph Women's Sport, Anna proudly declared, "We are rethinking sports coverage and creating a 21st century approach to sports media. We will showcase diverse women's voices, commit to nurturing new writing across different platforms, and while we want to highlight inequality, we do not want to define women's sport through that lens. Sportswomen are incredible, so let TWS be a space where stories stand on their own merit, not in comparison to men. As the United Nations puts it, sport has the power to unlock gender equality for women and girls around the world. I am proud that the Telegraph is leading this historic step to contribute toward that drive for change." I spoke to Anna in 2019 and asked her how things had gone in the early months of establishing the new section. "Of course there's challenges and we're talking about changing a structure. I don't just want us to work in a silo. We have women's sports specialist journalists, but it's really important that we work right across the range of writers that we have. And so that means having conversations around, okay, so what's our content going to be? I know you've written for 30 years and you've won every award under the sun, but..." And it's been wonderful that those male writers have been really open to that and interested and keen to do something new and fresh. I'm a huge fan of all the Telegraph has done, and there's no doubt that its investment in women's sport sent ripples across the media, encouraging other national newspapers to invest more in reporting and featuring women's sport on their pages. One of the most refreshing elements has been the way in which TWS has not been afraid to tackle controversial issues, from menstruation, motherhood, and sexual abuse, through to concussion, racism, and fat shaming. The team at the paper have covered topics that impact women and girls far beyond the world of sport. Anna and her team have created an environment where high-profile sportswomen feel comfortable to share unapologetically their stories with moments of joy and glory alongside emotional vulnerability. The voices of sportswomen have been amplified with regular columnists including sprinter Dina Asher-Smith, former Paralympic cyclist and swimmer Sarah Story, and footballer Jordan Nobbs, along with thought-provoking features from the likes of former England rugby player Maggie Alfonsi and former England cricketer Ebony Rainford-Brent. In January 2021, it was wonderful to see Naomi Osaka as guest editor of a monthly supplement dedicated to athlete activism. Anna has also explored new voices, giving a platform to a broad range of women beyond those typically reporting on sport, with guest writers including authors Pourna Bell and Caroline Criado Perez. TWS has helped to address the underrepresentation of women's sport, giving 29% more coverage to women's sport in its first year than any other newspaper. In fact, according to research from the Women's Sport Trust, the paper had near parity of key sports coverage over the summer of 2019, with 45% of lead sports articles featuring women's sport. It's no wonder TWS has already won multiple awards. We predicted that Telegraph Women's Sport would bring about a revolution in sports coverage, and it has, reflected Anna on the section's anniversary in 2020. We are thrilled to see women's sport elevated onto front pages and making national headlines, but there's still so much to be done in working towards parity for women and girls at all levels, from closing the school sport gender gap to equality for elite sportswomen. At TWS, we are committed to telling these stories, highlighting injustice and championing sports excellence along the way. Number 8. Netball Gold Commonwealth Games 2018. "It's pretty addictive watching international netball, isn't it?" was my husband's comment as he, like many others, found himself drawn to the games taking place during the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games in 2018. As a dad of three keen netballers, Matt's watched a lot of the sport courtside over the years, but I loved how he was now utterly drawn to watch these incredible female athletes at the very top of the international game. For England, the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast marked a significant moment in the team's history. In the past decade, the England Roses had consistently lost out to the Australia Diamonds or the New Zealand Silver Ferns in most major championships. By way of background to the huge success of these Southern Hemisphere teams, the game was originally introduced as women's basketball in around 1900 and rapidly spread across schools in both countries. Jumping forward to 2008, the ANZ Championship launched with five teams from Australia and five from New Zealand and regular TV coverage, becoming the first semi-professional netball league in the world. The league ran until 2016, when a new ANZ Premiership launched in New Zealand, and in Australia, Suncorp Super Netball launched, a new nationally exclusive league with increased funding and media coverage. By 2019, the salary cap for each team in the Suncorp League was around £300,000, with an additional £85,000 for clubs to provide players with employment, education, and to pay for ambassador roles, with accommodation and private health insurance also provided, and average pay for players around £40,000. Super Netball was the place to be if you were a woman wanting to earn a living in sport in Australia. I was lucky enough to visit Netball New South Wales in 2019, home to the Giants and Swifts, two of the top teams playing in the league. It was astounding to see the professional setup in Sydney and the enormous publicity generated, with players appearing on billboards and buses to promote the league. Many English players were understandably drawn to play down under, including Roses stars Helen Housby, Joe Harton, Serena Guthrie, Jeeva Mentor, and Nat Haythorn-Thwaite. It's this experience of training and competing with the best professional netballers in the world that may have made all the difference to the result at the Commonwealth Games on April the 15th, 2018. Pamela Cookie, former captain of the Roses, who had also played for a time in New Zealand but retired before the Commonwealth Games, told me about a defining moment for the England team in 2013 when they won a Test Series 3-0 against Australia. "That was where the belief started and where we saw it was now possible. It wasn't just a one-off game where we beat Australia or New Zealand, which we'd done in the past. It was three solid games. We saw they weren't unbeatable. They were just a group of players, two arms, two legs, just like the rest of us who played netball. The Commonwealth Games final followed a nail-biting semi-final against Jamaica, where, having been six goals down at one point, Joe Harton's dramatic goal in the last second clinched a 56-55 win. That in itself had been pretty emotional for the Roses, as they'd lost in the semi-finals of the past four Commonwealth competitions. History was already being made, as it was the first time since netball was introduced at the 1998 Games that Australia and New Zealand were not playing each other in the final. My sleepy daughters and I set our alarms for the middle of the night to be sure we didn't miss out on the historic final of England versus Australia. An incredible 1.8 million people in the UK did the same, and what a final it turned out to be. I was beginning to lose hope a little in the final quarter when England fell four goals behind, but they made an impressive comeback, and with just 20 seconds on the clock, it was 51-51, and England were taking the final centre pass. With just 5 seconds to play, Joe Harton missed a shot, and then so did Helen Housby. In terms of what then followed, you couldn't have written a better piece of sporting drama. The buzzer sounded, but a penalty shot was given for a contact on Housby. She calmly shot the goal that won Commonwealth gold. As a shooter, you dream of that moment. Commonwealth Games final, last second goal, but you never believe it's really going to happen. "It's the best day of my life," she later told the media. What followed in the coming months, and why that moment makes my top 12, was the profile that netball received in the UK and the enormous increase in women and girls playing the sport. The year closed with a final netball highlight, with the Vitality Roses winning two awards at the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Awards. Having been awarded Team of the Year, the Roses went on to beat the England men's football team, Alistair Cook, Tiger Woods and Tyson Fury, with the most public votes to win Greatest Sporting Moment of the Year. What a wonderful inspiration for any young and old netballers watching that night to hear the words of England captain Amma Agbaze. "It's been a very long journey. Billie Jean King said that you stand on the shoulders of those who went before you, and we're very tall girls. We've been standing on a lot of shoulders." Number 9. Barclays' sponsorship of the FA Women's Super League 2019. In what I feel was a watershed moment in 2019, Barclays announced the biggest ever investment a brand had made in women's sport in the UK. The multi-million pound partnership with the Football Association, worth over £10 million, saw the top tier of women's football renamed as the Barclays FA Women's Super League from the 2019-2020 season through to July 2022. It wasn't just elite sport that benefited from the investment, as the relationships of the FA, Barclays and the Youth Sport Trust working together to drive the growth of the women's game at grassroots level too. Barclays became the lead partner of the FA Girls Football School Partnerships, a nationwide scheme to increase girls' access to football at school, with the ambitious goal of all girls having equal access to football in schools by 2024. Commenting on the deal at the time of the launch, Jess Daly, Group CEO of Barclays, said, "Barclays' multi-year investment is also our salute to the professionalism of the FA Women's Super League players, and we hope it will help take the game to new heights, making England's domestic league a world leader. Our commitment to women's and girls' football at a crucial time in its development goes beyond pure sponsorship. We believe it can be a key to increasing participation, development, and the wider visibility of the female game." In addition to this huge public deal, Barclays also supported other organisations working behind the scenes to drive equality in the world of football. The Progressive brand increased its funding for Women in Football, the charity which lobbies against sexism in the game, and also sponsored my own podcast, The Game Changers, enabling me to create a number of new series dedicated to fearless women in football. Aside from the transformative impact Barclays funding will have on women's football in the UK, for me, this deal had even broader impact. The fact that a brand as big and powerful as Barclays, with a long-standing tradition of sponsoring men's sport in Britain, was backing women's sport on this substantial level, sent a powerful message to other brands considering entering this space. Here's hoping many other major brands will follow Barclays' lead. Number 10. The FIFA Women's World Cup 2019. The FIFA Women's World Cup was a game-changing event for women's sport on many levels. Globally, a reported 1.2 billion people watched it on television, the most in the history of the tournament. Half that vast audience were European, with viewing figures in South America up 500% from the Women's World Cup in 2015. An incredible 82 million people watched the final. In the UK, the profile of women's football reached new heights, with 28.1 million tuning in to watch the BBC coverage across the event, more than double the numbers from Canada 2015, which attracted 12.2 million. The BBC also reported 13.1 million match requests, live and on demand, on BBC iPlayer and BBC Sport. Millions watched Scotland in their first ever World Cup. 11.7 million watched England versus the USA in the semi-finals. If only we'd made the final, just think what the numbers might have been then. With a gender split of 62% male and 38% female for the total tournament audience, it was clearly not just women watching women's sport, as critics sometimes claim is the case. As players like Steph Horton, Ellen White, Karen Bardsley and Lucy Bronze became household names in England, this was the moment that propelled Megan Rapinoe to global stardom. Already established as a much-admired athlete activist for bravely being the first soccer player to take the knee in support of US football quarterback and civil rights activist Colin Kaepernick, it was her Twitter spat with US President Donald Trump that made us love her even more. Rapinoe had openly told reporters that she would not visit the White House if the US women's team won the World Cup. Her comments later went viral on social media when a video was released ahead of the quarterfinal against France, where she said to the camera that she was not going to the fucking White House. Trump couldn't resist taking to his beloved Twitter to respond. "I'm a big fan of the American team and women's soccer, but Meghan should win first before she talks. Finish the job." And she did just that, scoring a penalty in the final and winning the golden boot and golden ball in addition to the team trophy. And she didn't go to the White House. Number 11. Fallon Sherrock at the PDC World Championships 2019. After all the furore around the PDC deciding to stop using walk-on girls in dance in 2018, only to see they were still employing plenty of young women in skimpy shorts waving pom-poms as the official PDC dance dancers, I have to say, watching the dance wasn't a priority for me around Christmas 2019. That all changed with the arrival of Fallon Sherrock. There are a few firsts left for women in sport, but one that made global headlines was when, on December 17, 2019, Fallon Sherrock became the first woman to beat a man at the PDC World Championships, held at Alexandra Palace in London. What a pleasure to see the hundreds of noisy men in the crowd finally celebrating a woman for her talent and skill rather than the tightness of her top or the length of her legs. Fallon beat Ted Evetts 3-2 in the first round of the 2020 World Championship and spectacularly followed this up with a 3-1 win over 11th seed Mensur Suljovic in the second round. She finally lost 2-4 to Chris Dobby. Becoming a poster girl for the sport literally overnight, the affectionately named Queen of the Palace received supportive messages from the likes of Billie Jean King, with media from all over the world wanting to talk to her. Her Twitter following shot up from 15,000 to 100,000. She even appeared on Good Morning Britain the day after her first victory, winning more of the nation's hearts by beating Piers Morgan live on the show. Did he really think he stood a chance? I asked sports reporter Jackie Oatley, who's covered darts for many years, if she thought that Fallon's success would open the door for other women in the future. Well, this has been an absolute revelation, because there aren't too many sports first left, are there? She was so cool and so calm, and with the darts being such a meritocracy, it's not like football, where you can't have men playing against women. You can absolutely have women playing against men in darts. There is that psychological barrier for the men. Whatever people say, they really don't want to be on that big stage being booed and being beaten by a woman, even though Ted Evetts was incredibly magnanimous. It was phenomenal. The PDC is trying to grow the game into different territories, and that first victory almost overnight changed darts forever. Jackie was keen to remind me that whilst it was Fallon who made the headlines, there are lots of other fantastic female darts players breaking new ground, including Lisa Ashton, who won a tour card as a professional, and Mikuri Suzuki, the back-to-back women's champion. Who knows? Maybe I'll be watching the darts again in the future, after all. Number 12. Claire Connor, appointed president of the MCC 2020. Claire Connor, being named as the next president of the Marylebone Cricket Club, was symbolic of the enormous change in women's cricket when it was announced in the summer of 2020. The former England captain, who was named head of women's cricket at the England and Wales Cricket Board in 2007 and is now managing director of women's cricket, will become president of MCC in 2021. She will be the first woman in this prestigious role in the club's 233-year history, leading one of the oldest institutions in any sport and heading a club that did not even allow female members until 1998. Even now, MCC members are mostly male. According to The Telegraph, in 2019, MCC had 217 women as full members of the club, with a total membership of 18,000. That's just 1.2%. Considered by many the most exclusively male of sports, the gentleman's game has changed significantly for women in the past decade under the guidance of the much-admired Claire Connor. Such has been her impact that she's been awarded an MBE, an OBE and a CBE for her services to the game. Reflecting on her appointment, Claire told the BBC, "I am deeply honoured to be named as the next president of MCC. Cricket has enriched my life so deeply already, and now it hands me this wonderful privilege. We often need to look back to see how far we've come. I made my first visit to Lord's as a starry-eyed, cricket-obsessed 9-year-old girl at a time when women were not allowed in the long room. Times have changed. Now I find myself entrusted with this remarkable opportunity. The opportunity to play a part in helping MCC, cricket's most influential club, to thrive and grow in an even more modern and inclusive future. My belief is that the game is for everybody, and we haven't always behaved that way as a game. That's not a criticism of anybody. The game has, for a long time, been set up in this country and overseas to cater for men and boys. And we're at an exciting crossroads in society more widely and in sport and in cricket, where there is a huge commitment to making the game more inclusive and more diverse. And that's not just about gender, that's all areas of inclusion and diversity." Claire's appointment is symbolic of a wider shift for women's cricket as its popularity and growth continues across the world. "I was lucky enough to be at Lord's on July 23, 2017, to witness England women winning a thrilling World Cup final against India in front of packed and wonderfully noisy stands. March the 8th, 2020 saw another record-breaking attendance when 86,174 fans packed the Melbourne Cricket Club for the ICC Women's T20 World Cup final. Women's cricket needs more investment if it's ever to reach the level of the men's game, so it was hugely welcomed in 2020 when the ECB announced a funding boost for women's cricket of £20 million over the next 2 years to increase grassroots participation and make cricket a gender-balanced sport. The ultimate goal of the ECB is to invest £50 million over the following 5 years, which will ensure funding for 40 full-time professional domestic contracts, along with the existing professional contracts for England women's elite players, creating a pathway for under-11 to under-17 levels and raising the profile of the women's game through the 100, a new domestic tournament, which now begins in the summer of 2021. It's an exciting time for women's cricket, and with a woman like Claire Connor at the helm, it will get even better in the future. As I write this book, we have seen COVID's disproportionate impact on women's sport as the pandemic exposed the inequalities already at play in the wider sporting landscape. Across many sports, women's leagues and championships were cut before men's, and less investment available for testing and equipment has seen elite women's sports teams prevented from training and playing like their male counterparts. This has made employment more precarious for many professional and semi-professional female athletes. As sport returns, there's the added risk that the hugely reduced income across the entire ecosystem may see clubs fall back to prioritising their traditionally more profitable investment in men's sports. Despite concerns that the progress we have seen during the past decade could be lost completely, looking back at these incredibly positive 12 moments, I feel confident that this will not be the case. There have been too many significant changes that have caused us to shift our view on women's sport for that to happen. I look forward to witnessing many more in the next decade as we make our progress towards equality. As stated by UN Women in their report, COVID-19, Women, Girls and Sport, Build Back Better, women and girls must be equally participants and leaders in the process of building back better, so their gains are not lost and a better future for all becomes a reality, where women and girls can participate in, work with, govern and enjoy sport on an equal playing field. Thank you so much for listening to the serialisation of my book, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport. If you'd like a copy, it's available in hardback and paperback in all good bookshops and online. The Game Changers podcast is free to listen to on all podcast platforms. Head over to fearlesswomen.co.uk to find out more about all of the incredible game changers I've spoken to in previous series. There are over 100 of them, including elite athletes, journalists, coaches, scientists, broadcasters, and CEOs. As well as listening to all the episodes on the website, you can find out more about the Women's Sport Collective, a free, inclusive network for all women working in sport. And you can register for the Fearless Women newsletter, a weekly review of the global developments in women's sport. Do come and say hello on social media, where you'll find me on LinkedIn, Instagram and Twitter at Sue Anstis. Finally, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd be so grateful if you could do two things. Firstly, if you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, I'd really appreciate it. And secondly, if there's anyone in your life, at home or at work, who you think might enjoy the podcast, please do let them know about it and help us spread the word about women's sport and the stories of these incredible game changers.